Blog Talk Radio.
We own this country. We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
Welcome. It's Wednesday evening here, 7 o'clock Central Standard Time in Missouri, and you are listening to Missouri Grassroots Radio. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and this is your Culture Vigilante Hour. We're thrilled to be here with you again this evening. We're here every Wednesday night at the same time, and sitting in with us again this evening is Cindy McGee of Show Me Patriots. Good evening, Cindy.
Good evening, Lisa. Thank you for having me again.
Well, we're thrilled to have you, and Cindy is gearing up to have her own show here on Tuesday evenings alongside or right in front of Cynthia Davis, former State Representative Cynthia Davis. We'll have them both on Tuesday evenings with covering the Tuesday evening lineup. So, another busy week. We had a great show last week, a real full show, a lot of controversial legislation. There's always controversial legislation going through the House of Representatives and the Missouri Senate here in Missouri. The legislative session is always a whirlwind, and this year is no different. Last year we covered some of the controversy on right to work, and we're going to have Mark Mix with us tonight later on in the show of National Right to Work Organization to talk to us about the need for a right to work, and hopefully he's going to set us straight on some of the issues. There was some Tom Martz of Lock and Smith Foundation kind of brought up a question as to whether or not we already have right to work written into our Constitution. So hopefully Mark Mix will be able to give us enlighten us a little bit on that and tell us why we need this legislation. I'm sure that's the stance he's going to come from on that. But in just a few minutes, we're going to have William Estrada. Another piece of legislation going through the House of Representatives here is House Bill 513 by Kurt Barr, and it's a parental rights piece of legislation, and we're going to get some clarification on that as well. And later on, John Loudon, former state senator, former House of Representatives, served 16 years in the legislature here in Missouri, is now working in California doing a lot of right-to-work type stuff, union type, card check things, those kinds of things out in California. He's going to come back and be with us tonight and talk to us about unions here in Missouri, talk to us about right-to-work and some of the aspects of it from a legislative standpoint. We'll get his point of view. And we always love spotlighting the patriot groups. There are patriot groups all across the country, all across the state of Missouri, who are out there trying to champion a voice of conservatism. And we have a new one for you tonight. It's the Mommy Lobby. And you just knew that, I think it's women who are going to be the catalyst for turning things around in this country. Women are the foundational character backbone. Women stick to it when nobody else does. So Cindy Chaffian of the Mommy Lobby is going to come on and tell us about her organization. And they're a nationwide organization, and she's trying to reach out to everybody across the country and some folks here in Missouri, so we'll talk to her. So, Cindy.
Yes.
Crazy week. With all of the controversy over the gun legislation that has been filed here in Missouri, the gun confiscation legislation and the report your guns, it's through your school and all of that. There's just been an avalanche. I mean, it's almost comical. I haven't done any writing about it. I mean, I can't hardly keep up with the legislation that's being filed on both sides of the of the legislature. It's like a schoolyard fight. The left is filing just ridiculous legislation. Since we have a Republican-dominated House and Senate, you know that none of this stuff is ever going to see the floor. and they're just filing this ridiculous legislation. They're going to confiscate your guns, and they're going to, you know, I mean, all, you know, you can't have more than five rounds, whatever. All of this stuff is going on, and then the right is also filing just a boatload of stuff saying we're going to make it illegal for you to file this kind of legislation. I mean, there's all kinds of things going on. Have you ever seen anything? I mean, it's very serious. I don't want to make light of it at all, but have you ever seen anything so ridiculous in your life?
It's crazy, but I think, Lisa, it's also indicative of that we're in a real battle here for our Second Amendment rights. And I heard a very interesting interview today with a gentleman who just wrote a book called On the Brink, and he's talking about how our country is on the brink of losing everything. And he was discussing this federal attempt to take control of our guns and to really just completely gut the Second Amendment. And something interesting that he said was he was in Colorado, and he had been asked to go up there by the legislature, and they were state legislators there, and they were talking to him, and they informed him that apparently President Obama is doing something unprecedented for a president, although nothing would surprise me coming from this one. And he is calling state legislators around the country, encouraging them to file legislation in their states.
Really?
To support his gun law ideas, his attempt to basically gut the Second Amendment.
So that's where it's coming from.
In Colorado, they actually moved 8 Democrats to their side, and it looks like there's a good chance that that legislation will pass in Colorado. And the whole thing behind that, Lisa, is to give him some impetus to push this on a federal level, to push gun control on a federal level. And so he was, you know, that's something for us to really be concerned about. And when I listened to that today, I kind of wondered if that might not be what is behind some of this pro-gun control legislation that we're seeing these Democrats file, even though they really shouldn't stand a chance of it even seeing the light of day in Missouri. It might indicate, you know, that they're just trying to show support for Obama and what he's doing. Just a thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes perfect sense. But to me, it kind of seems, I mean, you know, until somebody strikes down the Second Amendment, I don't know what you can file on a state level that's going to trump the Second Amendment. And we've had that question about a lot of bills, not just the gun control bills. We've had that question about a lot of bills here in our state. You know, I mean, you know, there's the found money stuff, and there's just all kinds of stuff that's going on where, you know, they're filing all of this legislation on the state level, and these are national issues. You know, this stuff's all covered in the federal constitution. And we've got all of these state level legislators, you know, filing what, to me, a lot of it appears to be Yankee Doodle legislation. You know, it draws a lot of attention.
I'm not sure. I think that filing legislation to strengthen the Second Amendment might not be a bad idea. For example, from what I can see at this point, the legislation that's being filed there will be federal agents coming into the state to confiscate guns.
Mm-hmm.
That are manufactured or legally owned by citizens in the state of Missouri, that they can be arrested and face jail time and a stiff penalty. I don't think that's a bad idea, because something else that I was listening to a group of sheriffs being interviewed from around the country. One is from Missouri this evening, and they were talking about they will not do that, and they will push back at the feds if they come into their counties.
Excellent.
And So I think that state legislatures passing some of this legislation may not be a bad idea, because they're going to strengthen the position that the sheriffs are coming from and give them actual a penal code that they can use to arrest and fine and possibly jail these people if they come into our state and into their counties.
You know, and
so
I think that's the argument we're going to hear.
Yeah, I think looking at it from that perspective, it may not be Yankee Doodle legislation, but, you know, everything bears scrutiny. Everything needs to be held to account. And, you know, we have to be careful that we're not just passing legislation for the sake of looking good.
Well, yeah, that's true. And I kind of think that's the argument that we're going to hear tonight from William Estrada and Mark Mix, too, is that, you know, they're passing this legislation just, you know, to add some teeth to you know, to for nullification purposes, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But last week, Tom Martz made a very good point about the right to work legislation. It's a piece of legislation. You know, it's subordinate to anything in a state or a federal constitution. And if you can make it this year saying yes, you can make it next year saying no. So.
Correct.
You know, it's not, you know, we've become so accustomed. We file in excess of 2,000 pieces of legislation here a year. Legislators go to their state capitals thinking that that is the mark of success, is to file as much legislation as you can. And it's, you know, I think we've forgotten, or we've been conditioned not to remember, that it's just a piece of legislation and it is subordinate to constitutional statutes, for lack of a better word. So,
right.
I don't know.
And I think something as important as gun control, if they're going to file something to strengthen our position in Missouri in favor of the Second Amendment, to put in place penal codes that will address the federal government trying to come in, their agents trying to come in to usurp our Second Amendment rights, I would hope that they would do that by making an amendment to our Constitution rather than a state statute. And, you know, you know, certain penal codes and things of that nature that the legislature passed legislation on,
mm-hmm.
Deal with criminals and so forth. I don't have a problem with that being statute, because maybe down the road it does need to be revisited and changed, and it's easier to do that way. But some things, if you're going to do them, then do them right from the beginning.
Okay, here's my question about that. About also making, okay. Nullification, you're going to need it. I mean, we obviously have a president who thinks he's a dictator. You know, nullification is probably something that we need to take more seriously. Okay, however, okay, now if we start making statutes to back up constitutional issues, and, you know, every time you pass a law, it just kind of tightens the noose around your liberty. So do you then narrow the broadness of the constitutional wording, if you're passing statutes, does it do any? It could it possibly hurt you? Is what I'm getting at here. I'm a little worried about that.
Well, yeah, I think there's room for concern there. I think in the going back to this the gun legislation they're trying to pass this year. Now again, it needs to be an amendment, not just a statute. The penalty for anyone trying to come in and confiscate guns.
Mm-hmm.
That particular. I wish I could. I'm totally blank. The number of the bill is not in my head right now. But I think that in doing that, if they make that an amendment, I think that's strong, and it doesn't weaken the Constitution. And I think that all that does is really gives the powers that be in each state the opportunity to, or in the state of Missouri, for us to defend our Second Amendment rights and what we're guaranteed under the Constitution, and to say if there is a federal overreach in the state of Missouri, those federal agents coming into our state are going to face the due process, the law of Missouri, and they're going to face jail time and a fine
mm-hmm.
if they come in here and try to do that. And again, I go back to our sheriffs are actually the last line in the sand against tyranny. A lot of people don't realize that. And the Supreme Court has upheld that with Sheriff Mack's case several years ago. And so I think that, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Tom Martz could come on and set me straight. But
I don't pretend
to be a constitutional expert. But
that's
kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, there was some pushback, I think, from our conversation on the air last week about the right to work stuff. So when Mark Fix comes on a little bit later on, we'll have him on and kind of set us straight on that. But, you know, it's all up to interpretation. I wish it was a little more clear. Anyway, I think that's where the direction is going to go tonight, folks. I think we're going to be talking about these pieces of legislation shoring up our constitutional rights. And let's take a quick break here, and we will come back with William Estrada in just a minute.
This is the Gun Owners Minute. Missouri House Democrats introduced Bill Number 545, an anti-gun bill, which would turn law-abiding firearm owners into criminals. They will have 90 days to turn in their guns if the legislation is passed. This is what's in the bill. Any person who, prior to the effective date of this law, was legally in possession of an assault weapon or large-capacity magazine shall have 90 days from such effective date to do any of the following, without being subject to prosecution. 1. Remove the assault weapon or large capacity magazine from the state of Missouri. 2. Render the assault weapon permanently inoperable. Or 3. Surrender the assault weapon or large capacity magazine to the appropriate law enforcement agency for destruction, subject to specific agency regulations. It also states unlawful manufacture, import, possession, purchase, sale, or transfer of an assault weapon or a large capacity magazine is a Class C felony. Thank God that Missouri has a pro-gun House and Senate with a veto-proof majority. This has been the Old Patriot.
So dear, for peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We are happy to be back, have with us back again William Estrada from parentalrights.org. He's been on with us before discussing the value of passing the Parental Rights Amendment in the United States House and Senate, and they also work very closely with the states trying to shore up those rights in the states, and Missouri is one of several states that has a bill in their legislature now. Ours is House Bill 513, introduced by Kurt Barr, that is a model of what parentalrights.org is trying to do all across the country as to help shore up parental rights across the United States. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Estrada. Welcome back.
Great to be on. Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. So I think when I contacted you a week or so ago, we read this bill. It's House Bill 513, introduced by Kurt Barr, and it's a short bill, and it's kind of vague, and there's some wording in here that we're kind of trying to get a hold on to make sure that it's going to do for us, give us the kind of strength and the kind of power as parents in our state. And maybe you can give us some clarification about how parentalrights.org has got those kinds of things structured.
Well, I'd be happy to, Lisa. First off, I'm the Director of Federal Relations for parentalrights.org. And as Lisa said, we've been trying for several years now to get a federal amendment to the United States Constitution that would preserve the right of parents to direct the education and upbringing of their children. Our parental rights are under attack, UN treaties, activist courts, international law, and the best way to protect them would be an amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Unfortunately, the political winds have not been very sympathetic to the plight of parental rights, and although we're continuing to push for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, that's a little ways off. We're just looking at the political reality. So recently we've begun working with Homeschool Legal Defense Association, with concerned parents all around the country, and in several states we have bills like Missouri House Bill 513, which would be state statutes to protect parental rights. The goal is to ensure that where most of the battles are fought, which are at state courts with state family court judges and in the state legal system, that parental rights are put in black and white in the code, that they're preserved, and that they are a fundamental right.
Okay. So, you know, family courts are not real, I mean, they're not real family friendly anymore. And a lot, I mean, I hear it all the time from women, especially, sometimes men too, but I mean, it seems like that parental rights are being violated constantly in the family court system, you know, when they shouldn't be, you know, when parents are perfectly capable of taking care of their kids, or maybe they should be giving, you know, custody of children to, you know, a next of kin or immediate family members. And of course, the issue is you always want to put the protection of the child first. That's the utmost
right
concern. But the second part of this bill, it says neither the state of Missouri nor any political subdivision of the state shall infringe this right without demonstrating that its governmental interest as applied to the person is of the highest order and not otherwise served. So concerning language in there. Maybe there's some things about the way this is worded that is not clear to the layperson, but the governmental interest. Okay, so the governmental interest is as applied to the person is of the highest order and not otherwise served. Okay, again, of course you want the safety of the child to be the first priority, but what is the governmental interest? What does that actually mean? Does that supersede the parental authority?
No, that's a great question, Lisa. And here, it's a very simple four-paragraph bill. The first paragraph says simply, the liberty of a parent to direct the upbringing, education, and care of his or her child is a fundamental right. And that tracks with almost 100 years of Supreme Court jurisprudence that we have going back to 1925, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, where the U.S. Supreme Court said the child is not the mere creation and creature of the state. The parents have the fundamental right to direct the education and upbringing of that child. So paragraph one is just really clear, saying it's a fundamental right, meaning it's the highest right that parents have to direct the education and upbringing of their children. And as conservatives, Lisa, you and I believe that, you know, these rights come from God, not from government, and that the government, as our Declaration of Independence says, is there to protect these rights. So that brings us into the second paragraph, which says that the state of Missouri, nor any political subdivision, meaning a county or a city, shall infringe, neither the state of Missouri nor any political subdivision of the state shall infringe this right without demonstrating that its governmental interest as applied to the person is of the highest order and not otherwise served. And this is, it's kind of a weird-sounding way that it's been written, but this is what the Supreme Court has said is the only way the government can ever impinge on a fundamental right, if it's of the highest order, not otherwise served. So what does that mean in real life? It means that the state, the government, does have a very high, it's the highest responsibility the government has, which is to protect life. That's that highest order. The governmental interest as applied to the person is of the highest order. And then what's the least restrictive way the government can go and can act on this? Well, let's look at it with a family. The government wants to ensure that children are safe, that their right to life is protected. The only way they can ever infringe on the fundamental right of parents to make decisions for their children is if they can show this high duty to make sure that children are safe. The only way they can act on it is by removing the children or by using the government's best interest to come and override the parental rights. So this would look like in a situation where parents are abusing their children or neglecting their children. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the vast majority of parents love their children very deeply, which is why we all believe that parents, not the government, should be making decisions for children. But there are those terrible instances where parents abuse or neglect or harm their children, and that's when the government could then exercise its governmental interest as applied to the person, meaning just in that specific instance, the way that they would do it is of the highest order, meaning that it's incredibly important to protect the life of this child, and it's not otherwise served. There's no lesser way the government can come in and protect that child's life. So that's all that this section means, that this fundamental right of parents can only be interfered with by the government when the government can show that the child's life or safety is in grave danger and they have to come in and remove that child. Then paragraph 3 says that this section applies to all laws of this state and all of the laws that are enacted before or after, meaning that the government, 10 years down the road in Missouri, can't pass another law trying to usurp parental rights. And then the fourth paragraph is just saying that it's enacted after the date when passed by the Missouri legislature. So that's simply what House Bill 513 does.
Okay, so let me ask you this question then. Okay, of the highest order, is there a part somewhere in a legal definition that is not clear to the layperson about what the highest order is? Does the court have to prove? Because
yes.
Oftentimes, there are cases after cases after cases where the courts are taking kids away from parents because they think that the parents are you've had examples, they're sending them to church too much, or they don't like the way the parents are talking to the kids, or, there's not really evidence that the child is being abused in many of these cases.
Well, in answer to the first part of the question, yes, the government would have to show with the vast bulk of the evidence that the parents are abusing the child, that it's, again, of the highest order. So if a government social worker and the court and the lawyer came in and said, well, we think that the parents are abusing the child because they're bringing the child to church too many times, our lawyers would argue, well, under this statute, it's not of the highest order. The government can't say, well, protecting a child from church attendance, which unfortunately has happened in some cases,
mm-hmm.
This is not being made up. These are cases that we've seen. We would argue that it's not of the highest order, that the highest order would only be protecting that child's life and safety. Unfortunately, you know, in answer to your second question, you are right, Lisa, and there are instances where the courts, after looking at all the evidence, have gotten it wrong, and they have taken away children from loving parents, put them into foster care or in some other state, sanctioned authority, and we believe that it's been a violation of parental rights. This statute is very good. HSLDA, Homeschool Legal Defense, supports it. ParentalRights.org supports it. We are pushing for its passage in the Missouri legislature, but it's not the only answer. I mean, there are still, judges could still, I think, use this and cause problems for parental rights. It would be a vast step in the right direction. It would give the vast majority of families protection. But we still, number one, need to work on a federal parental rights amendment. And number two, we need to hold our judges accountable that they are not running roughshod over the fundamental right of parents to raise their children. It goes back to the fundamental question, who is best equipped to raise children, loving parents or even a well-intentioned bureaucrat who doesn't know that child's name until they just met the child?
Absolutely. Well, and I talked to Mr. Barr last week and asked him some questions about this bill, and he also mentioned to me that there are some Democrats filing I don't want to say similar bills, but some maybe more specific bills that help to protect or may in some way strengthen. Do you find that that's kind of the case in conjunction with this bill, 513, and others like it across the country, that supplemental bills are being filed to kind of help strengthen the language and the parental rights?
You know, Lisa, we are finding that. And we live in a day and age where it seems like the political parties are even more polarized than ever. But the exciting thing is that parental rights are not a Republican issue or a Democrat issue or a liberal or conservative issue. President Obama loves his two daughters as much as you or I love our children. And it's something where everyone can agree that we want what's best for our children. And parents are the ones who should be making these decisions. And I have actually very good news. There was a hearing yesterday for House Bill 513. In committee, not one person spoke in opposition. Several people spoke in favor of the bill, and the committee members, Republicans and Democrats, all of them were very supportive. And so we're very optimistic that this bill will soon be voted out of committee, and then if Missourians keep the pressure up on their representatives in the Missouri House, we could see this pass the House, then hopefully pass the Senate and be signed by the governor.
That's excellent news. Great news. We will keep an eye on this bill and watch it as it goes through and keep track of it for you folks. Thank you, William Estrada. We really appreciate you checking in and weighing in on this subject with us. We really really do want to see these kinds of rights be strengthened for the folks here in Missouri, for the parents and the children, because when the parents have authority over their children, the children always benefit from that. So we appreciate the fine work that you folks do at parentalrights.org. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. And if people want to track House Bill 513 specifically, you can visit parentalrightsmo.org, parentalrightsmo as in Missouri.org.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And go to parentalrights.org and sign their petition there. I believe you have a petition online?
We do, yes.
For the National Parental Rights Amendment?
Right.
Okay, very good. William Estrada, parentalrights.org. Please come back soon and keep us updated.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks. Talk to you soon. Okay, we're going to take a break, and we will be right back.
You live here?
Yes.
Well, maybe you know what a zombie is.
When a person dies and is buried, it seems there's certain voodoo priests who have the power to bring him back to life.
Horrible.
It's worse than horrible, because a zombie has no will of his own. You see them sometimes walking around blindly with dead eyes, following orders, not knowing what they do, not caring. You mean like Democrats?
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We just had a great conversation with William Estrada of parentalrights.org explaining to us the fine points of House Bill 513, the parental rights bill that's going through the House right now. We will keep an eye on that for you and let you know how that moves. Hopefully they'll vote it out of committee sometime very soon, and the parental rights in Missouri will be strengthened. And with us tonight, we have the president of the National Right to Work Organization, Mr. Mark Mix. He has been a strong proponent for right to work across the country, and he has been here a strong proponent for right to work. And he's here to help us clear up some questions that we've had about the right to work issue here in Missouri. Big battle going on now. I don't even know how many bills are filed in the House and the Senate for right to work. There's at least five. Thank you for being with us tonight, Mr. Mix.
Lisa, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity to be on and talk about right to work in Missouri.
First of all, right to work. 24 states have right to work. Is that correct?
That is correct. Indiana and Michigan joined the ranks of right to work in 2012, and hopefully there'll be more states that will join those ranks shortly.
And it's the evidence is overwhelming that right to work has benefited the economies of those states. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. In Indiana, the evidence is growing, and in Michigan, of course, the right to work law has not yet gone into effect. It will go into effect on March 27th after they passed it on December 11th of last year. The bill will actually go into effect at the end of March. And I believe, and the evidence indicates, that Michigan will have the same benefits that Indiana is experiencing, that Oklahoma is experiencing, that Idaho is experiencing. Those are the last four states to pass right to work laws.
Now, you've been working on right to work for a very long time. You've been with National Right to Work since 99. And one of the questions that I have for you, I mean, I do want to definitely dive very heavily into our state issue, but there's a national right to work issue. I have been reading things from Rand Paul. He's very supportive of national right to work. Why is right to work something that the federal government wants to put forth? Why is that not just a state's issue?
Well, Lisa, that's a great question, and it's one that we get quite often. A lot of politicians who try to avoid the right-to-work issue, some at the state level will say, well, it's a federal issue. Some at the federal level will say it's a states' rights issue. But you have to understand the history of compulsory unionism in America and understand that it was developed in 1935 during the New Deal. Franklin Roosevelt lobbied very heavily for the passage of what is called the Wagner Act, now known as the National Labor Relations Act. And that particular legislation, after it passed the Supreme Court's constitutional muster, which was a story in and of itself, basically applied labor policy from the federal government down to the states. And that particular legislation granted union officials the privilege to have a worker fired for failure to tender dues or fees. In that case, back then, it was to fail to join a union. In 1935, 1936, 1937, all the way up to 1947, and then actually all the way to 1961, you could actually be forced to join a labor union as a condition of getting or keeping a job. And that federal compulsory unionism power is what allows union officials in Missouri today to force workers to pay union dues in order to keep their jobs. So the forced unionism that is part and parcel of Missouri's public policy is not a result of what Missouri's done. It's a result of what the federal government has done. And so what Rand Paul has done is he's introduced a bill in Congress. Senate Bill 304, I believe, is the number. I think that's right. And that bill does not add one single word to federal law. It simply repeals the provisions in federal law that authorize forced unionism. So if that bill passed, there would be no reason for states to pass right-to-work laws because compulsory unionism would now be illegal under the federal labor policy. Now, that goes a little bit farther, and I don't mean to get too deep into this, but, you know, we believe prior to 1935, well, I should say prior to 1935, state law dictated terms and conditions of the relationship between employers and employees. When the federal government grabbed it, they created this forced unionism regime. And so the national right-to-work law would actually change the law and say that the bias in federal law is in favor of voluntarism, meaning you couldn't be forced to pay dues to get a job. But in the meantime, since 1947, states have had the rights to pass right-to-work laws and do it on their own if they choose to do so. And that's what 24 states have chosen to do.
Okay, and Missouri is quickly following in the footsteps of those 24 states. And you've been here in Missouri lobbying for right to work, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. We were back there. I was there on the 6th of February in a hearing that started at 8 o'clock in the morning in the House of Representatives. And we had 2.5 hours of testimony in the morning and went back in and had 3.5, 4 hours of testimony on House Bill 77, which is Eric Burleson's bill. And there was a healthy debate on that. The committee hasn't taken action at this point, I don't believe yet, on moving that bill to the floor.
As far as I know, I think I checked it today. Yep, it's just still sitting in committee, and it's not gone anywhere. Okay, so the controversy with House Bill 77, I mean, as you see it, I'm sure you're following all the bills here in Missouri on right to work. Is 77 the go-to bill? Because that seems to be the one that's got the most juice in it.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what they're going to end up doing. We had an opportunity to talk to the Speaker of the House about what his plans were, and he didn't. When we were down there on the 6th, he didn't indicate that there was a specific plan to move the bill forward. There's a couple bills in the Senate that we'd like to see the Senate actually take action on a right-to-work bill. But look, I think the people of Missouri are ready for the legislature to decide to tell them who's for freedom and who's for coercion. I mean, that's really the start of this program. It's how the program started in Oklahoma. It's how the program started in Indiana. And basically, the people of Missouri, it's the show me state. Show me whether you're for right to work or whether you're continuing forced unionism. That's the first step in moving the right to work bill forward.
Okay. The libertarian faction in Missouri is bubbling up. They're becoming more vocal. They have kind of a different angle on right to work. There's a lot of libertarian voice out there that's kind of saying, you know, we think that the business owner should have the control over it. And what right to work does, a lot of what they're seeing in the legislation is that it gives the employee the power. Now, I understand, you know, the reason unions are the way they are is because they have complete, you know, they've become large and corrupt like things do when they become large. Unions became unions because employers were abusing employees early on. But now we have things like, minimum wage, we have child labor laws. Why is it that we're approaching right to work from an employee standpoint and not giving the employer more control over whether or not they become unionized?
Well, that's a great question, and I have a lot of respect for the so-called pure libertarian philosophy about this, but they're missing the point. I mean, already federal law takes away the right for employers to contract. I mean, the idea that union officials have been granted monopoly bargaining power, the ability to bind you in an agency relationship without your consent, is the original sin. And I think every libertarian would agree with me on this, Lisa, that, you know, when government gets involved and forces someone to accept a contract that they don't want, you know, that's the original sin. So libertarians, they ought to get organized, and they ought to get mobilized, and they ought to go back to Washington, and they ought to repeal the original sin of the National Labor Relations Act. I would agree that the real problem is the ability to bind employees without their consent. And so we wouldn't want to interfere with an employer or employee contract, but those rights have been violated already by the National Labor Relations Act. And so, yeah, you might say that right to work is a half measure in the case of actually getting back to the libertarian philosophy of the right to contract. But until we can repeal the entire the Labor Relations Act under federal law and go back to those agency contract relationships that are common law, we believe the right thing to do is take away the compulsion and disincentivize the union officials' desire to force everyone into these collectives in the first place. If you take away their ability to force every worker to pay them, then we believe that unions will go back to representing only those workers that want to join them voluntarily, and then the relationship between employers and employees changes, and we get back to the original assumptions in what is a contractual relationship. I mean, you know, I'd like to be able to solve all the problems in one fell swoop, but the idea that a private organization can bind someone and cost them their livelihood because they will not tender dues or fees to them for the privilege of working is enough of an injustice that we ought to try to correct with the right to work law.
Right. Okay. We have, as part of our Missouri Constitution, we have a section in our Missouri Constitution. I'll just read it to you. Article 1, Section 29, that employees shall have the right to organize and bargain collectively through representatives of their own choosing. Now, the question has been brought up, don't we already have right to work?
No, you don't, because the state law, the state labor policy for private sector workers is preempted by the federal law. And so the federal law says that workers, that union officials can negotiate contracts that require people to pay them a fee for working. Now, what the Missouri constitutional language you just read to me basically says that everyone has the right to join and organize. And that is a right that everyone in the country has. It doesn't have to be in the Missouri Constitution because the Constitution of the United States has already been upheld to say that workers can join a union, organize, and bargain collectively. So it's kind of a redundancy on federal labor policy. But when it comes to the issue of forced unionism, that Missouri constitutional language, while it protects your right to join a union, doesn't protect you from compulsory unionism.
Okay. Yeah, that was the big question. We had a huge debate about that here last week on the show. And, you know, depending on how you read it or how you interpret it, and your knowledge of the Wagner Act, I'm assuming is what you're talking about, it can get pretty sticky. So is this basically a case where, you know, you need these state statutes to kind of clarify and push back at the federal statutes? Is this kind of a nullification issue in some ways?
Well, in some ways it is, Lisa, and it goes to what was passed in 1947 called the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Taft-Hartley Act amended the National Labor Relations Act that was passed in 1935. And instead of repealing the federal authorization for forced unionism, what it did give the states the right, if they could affirmatively restore the rights of individual employees, they could outlaw the closed shop. So in one sense, the government, you know, took away the rights of individual employees, whether or not to join or pay dues to the union as a condition of employment. But then in 1947, the federal government gave the states the right to outlaw the closed shop. And that's the authorization that allows the states to pass right to work laws. And that's what Missouri's trying to do here, is they're trying to say, we, as the state of Missouri, now exercise our rights, our federally granted rights under Section 14B of the Taft-Hartley Act, to outlaw the forced payment of fees as a job condition in Missouri. And that's specifically what the bills do. That's specifically what right-to-work laws do. But yet, in any state, even where there's forced unionism, there's language similar to the language you read me that says, yeah, you have the right to join a union. And that's no one even contests that. I mean, we believe that every worker who wants to join a union should be able to join a union, should be able to pay dues, should be able to try to bargain collectively and get the unions to do that on their behalf, but no one should be forced, and that's really the issue.
Okay, very good. Mark Mix, nationalrighttowork.org, we really appreciate you coming on and clarifying that for us. If you have any questions about right to work in general,
NRTW.org. You got
NRTW.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Thank you so much. Thank you for your help today, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again as this moves through the legislature here.
It'd be a great pleasure to talk with you again, Lisa. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for all your help. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for grass fire alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice, combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri. No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
Our well-being at home and our leadership abroad are inextricably linked. Our friends and allies must again be able to trust us. From Israel to Colombia, from Poland to the Philippines, our allies and friends have to know that we will be reliable and consistent and determined. And our foes can have no reason to doubt our resolve, because peace really does come through strength.
Just when you thought it was all over, when you thought it was time to hang it all up, Lisa is back.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you are listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We are back. We just had a great interview with Mark Mix. Cindy, he really kind of drove it home on a lot of those points that we were debating last week about, and really a kind of right to work on a state level is very much intertwined with right to work on a national level, which is something
I wasn't
as clear on that as I was before.
Right. I that was a very helpful interview for me, because it really helped clarify some things. And while one could certainly see that perhaps we have right to work based on Article 1, Section 29 in the Missouri Constitution, when you do look at the federal law and how that affects the states without right to work, then you understand that, you know, there is no protection from forced unionism without the Right to Work Act.
Yeah, I mean, it's that nullification issue, and it just kind of keeps popping up in various ways that, you know, when federal government has become so large and so powerful that you just do not have the ability to push back unless you bring in, you know, unless you become very 10th Amendment strong and states' rights supersede the federal federal law's mandates. So, yeah.
I agree.
Okay, we're gonna move on. That was a great interview. So, I mean, last week I was very much in the camp of the Locke and Smith folks. I thought that the Missouri Constitution, the way it was worded, was very clear that we pretty much had right to work in this state. Well, maybe not. We're going to have somebody on with us, Mr. John Loudon, former state senator, former House of Representatives, 16 years in the Missouri legislature. A lot of experience with this kind of thing, a lot of experience with the Missouri legislature for sure, has moved on and has done a lot of work in this area on the right to work and card check and all of those things. He's going to give us kind of a union perspective. Thanks for being with us tonight, John.
Hey, glad to be with
you. You know, my last interview finished a little quickly, and I had to pull you on a little bit before you were ready. Thanks for being so flexible. I'm so sorry.
No problem.
Okay, so John Loudon, former state senator here in Missouri, you have moved on. You're now in California. We miss you here in Missouri. You and Gina are well missed out here. But you guys are doing very important work out there. What are you doing out there now in California?
Well, thank you for that. And I tell you, I miss the Show Me State every day. I was just on an email group chat about a lawyer who said, if anybody comes to Missouri, it's a national group, said, if you ever come to Missouri, I'll fix your ticket for you. And in California, they don't fix your tickets for you. In fact, they run the government off tickets. You know, that your traffic ticket has like $100 state tax attached to it. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, my God.
But, anyway, but I tell you what, there are a couple things that I don't miss about Missouri, and it's one of them is the cowardice of the Republican Party in Missouri not to want to fight for the good of the state. And I tell you, the reason for my fight in this, the reason I'm so passionate about it is simple. I sat with an economic development bureaucrat. And I said, this was during a Democrat administration. We were at a polite dinner. It was a chamber luncheon kind of a thing. And I said, what's the number one thing we can do, I as a lawmaker, to make this state the best place to live and work and attract jobs? And she didn't blink. She said, right to work. And she went on. Now, this woman's boss was a former Democrat state rep. Carnahan was the governor, Democrat governor. And she was risking her job, but she was so passionate. There was one truth, and she was going to risk her job to say it, and she went on to detail. It was like my jaw dropped that this woman's volunteering this, and she said half the calls that they get from companies thinking about coming to Missouri end when they tell them we're not a right-to-work state. Fully half the businesses in this country bypass all the forced union states, and all the right-to-work states just enjoy all that prosperity that jumps right over us.
Absolutely. And I think actually in the hearing that I didn't actually attend hearing for House Bill 77, but it was full of union support there, and their answer to bringing prosperity to Missouri was more tax credits.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And you know, this is the union Democrat, you know, cartel that likes to talk every day about how against corporate welfare they are.
Right.
And
they're running the show.
And the other thing they like to talk about is sustainability.
Oh.
When half the states are being jumped over and their answer is let's give away tax credits, the states that win are the ones that have the most tax credits and the most other things going for them. So it's a race to the bottom where states, the pathetic, least competitive half of the country, those states are competing against each other with tax credits. You're shrinking your general revenues, and so you're raising taxes on the businesses that stay and on the people. And so it creates an unsustainable death spiral. Every politician who's honest knows it. It's just a political game. These are laws of science. They're just immutable. And any politician that won't get behind right to work is being dishonest.
Well, they're dancing here. I mean, they are literally dancing around right to work. I mean, we have, you know, as you know, we have a majority House and Senate, Republican House and Senate legislature, and they're dancing, and they are trying. We haven't seen any movement since the Senate hearings on 77. That seems to be the bill that has all the legs with it. But they wanted to put this on the ballot in November and charge the taxpayers $7.5 million to have a special election because they didn't want to put it up for a vote.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Whatever the cowardly body with the supermajority wants to do, you know, I say do it. Whatever it takes, where it'll pass, because the momentum, people understand this, because there's another very basic level that you, as a freedom-minded person, embodies as much as about anybody out there. What is more fundamental? You've got the best factory, the best jobs in town, might be that union, that union factory, and there might not be a whole lot of other job prospects, but you can't work there unless you're paying money to the union. I mean, that is just
right.
Or you'll lose your job. And what is more fundamental than the right to earn a livelihood, than a right to provide your family without being forced to join? And by the way, what do we know about so that union that holds the monopoly? When's the last time you heard of a union that gave really lousy service getting voted out? It's very difficult to vote these out. They amass power, just like politicians. And so they're the incumbent. They know the structure. They know how to rig the elections. They can give as lousy service as they want, and you still have to write them a check every month. In fact, you don't even write the check. They just take it from you. So it's just so fundamentally un-American. And so the beauty and really the disgusting lie, rather, that the other side has been able to get away with is that being pro-right to work is being anti-union. No, being pro-right to work is being in support of a competitive environment, giving the worker the choice about whether they want to pay for the service they're getting or if they think they're getting lousy service and they don't want to pay for it.
So that has been the question, John. There has been a question, and I talked to Mark Mix about this a few minutes ago. It really needs to be clarified, I guess, because right to work really does rest with the employee. The employer does not have the authority to choose union shop or not, but it's really not an anti-union bill because you can have unions in your place. You just don't have to join the union.
Exactly, and you really have to focus on the workers here because once if we could get rid of that one damn lie, and it is a damn lie, the only reason to have a forced union environment is to support lazy unions that aren't doing a good job. So, because if you're a good union, you ought to be proud to operate in a right-to-work state. There are lots of good unions that provide service and have happy members because they have to compete for that money. If you're not doing a good job, the worker has the power to say, I'm not going to contribute to you because I don't think you're doing your job. And if the bad union dies, then maybe the better union will come in and take over. But it's so forced unionism is the worst thing for workers. You're stuck with bad service, and you're paying for bad service. Where else in our economy do we force people to pay for bad service except for government?
Right. So let's talk about the strength. Yeah, let's talk about the strength of the union here in Missouri as you see it, because part of the concern here is this bill that seems to be the main bill, House Bill 77, has got a rider in it to put it on the ballot. Are you still there, John? We're getting some interference. Okay. It's got a provision in it to put it on the ballot in November. Well, we don't have a general election scheduled for November, so it's going to cost the taxpayers more than $7 million if they do that and they don't take that language out of it and put it up for just an up or down vote on the floor, and then you know if it goes to a general election, I mean that's going to be a hell of a fight. You know,
well,
the unions are going to spend a lot of money.
Well, that's true. The unions will spend a lot of money, and it will be a fight. But I think the voters ultimately will win. You take away all the arguments about well it's going to hurt Republicans in elections, they're going to get clobbered if it's on in November, if you do that. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's not ideal, and the cost presents challenges. But I'm really not ready to totally get down in there and say this is terrible and that is a better alternative. The best ideal would be that you just put it on or that the legislature just passes it and overrides the veto. Because again, no Republican is being honest. And you know, I agree with these Republicans, oh, well, I'm in a tough district. Well, you know what? If it's literally saving the baby's life, I mean, we're talking about saving the economy in Missouri. Where are the lawmakers that are willing to go down for it? You know, I'll pass right to work. It may be the last thing I do. I may lose my seat. Well, so be it. You'll be in a prosperous state that you can be proud to sacrifice for. But better than that.
Yep, absolutely. John, are you in the ocean?
I am. Sorry. My office is right on the street in a little village here outside of San Diego. And I get a little traffic. Sorry.
It's not It sounds like you're enjoying that beautiful view that I see on Facebook, on Gina's Facebook page.
You know what? They say in California that, they tax the crud out of you, but you're paid back in the weather.
Sounds like it.
And there is that. So, my little boy started spring baseball last week. Same time Cardinals are starting spring training. They're starting baseball here. So, it was that.
Okay. Well, John Loudon, we're losing you. I feel like you're drowning out here. Stay away from the shark. Thanks for being on with us tonight, and thanks for helping us with this issue. We hope you'll come back and keep us posted.
Okay, thanks. I sure will keep fighting. It's the most critical issue to the state of Missouri.
Thank you, John. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you, Lisa.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. John, are you there?
This is the Gun Owner's Minute. Everyone who's a gun owner knows just how difficult it is to purchase ammunition in certain calibers that gun owners are stocking up on. But have you noticed that .22 caliber ammunition is now almost impossible to purchase or find? Some have stated that Homeland Security is purchasing these by the truckloads. Is this because Janet Napolitano and her Homeland Security police are rabbit or squirrel hunting on their time off? I don't even want to think.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Okay, this is Lisa Payne Nager. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour, Missouri Grassroots Radio. And it's been a right to work evening. It's been a legislature evening. It's been a legislation evening. Everything kind of boils down to, it's put up or shut up here in Missouri. If you want to maintain your rights, you need to stick, your legislature needs to put their money where their mouth is and support these bills. There's a lot of federal overreach going on that's kind of dictating some of this nastiness and where right to work is concerned and where parental rights is concerned. We need to, shore up those lines and make sure that we maintain that strength here in the state of Missouri. Let's move on. I think during the break I told Cindy we were going to talk preparedness, but I think our next caller is on the line, so maybe we'll move to that and we'll talk preparedness after the next break. Folks, we have always had the pleasure of highlighting and illustrating some great grassroots groups. People that are organizing on a local level are the heart of the movement, and they've done a very good job of awakening the sleeping lion or the sleeping tiger and making people aware. And on the line with us tonight, we have Cindy Chaffian of the Mommy Lobby. She has started an amazing organization of very concerned, conservative women, mommies, who seem to be at the core of what we're trying to do to turn around this country. Cindy, thank you for being with us. The Mommy Lobby sounds wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on with y'all tonight.
So we had a short conversation earlier this week about the Mommy Lobby, and like so many other groups, you're new at this. You haven't been doing this for a very long time, and you're motivated by your fear for the future, for yourself and for your children, and for representing that group of that there's a demographic out there of conservative women who are kind of underrepresented. So
yes,
that's what motivated you to get the Mommy Lobby started.
It really is, Lisa. Basically, I'm a mom of five, and I was married to a naval officer. He was in the military for 20 years, and raising my children, I spent most of my time dedicating, my life to that. And about 4 or 5 years ago, all of a sudden I woke up and I realized in the process of raising my children and my busy life, I really didn't know as much as I needed to know. And I started to pay more attention, and I started to study, and I started to get a little bit more involved. And I actually went looking for an organization that was specifically dedicated to moms, conservative moms in general. And, I wanted something that would provide information for moms who really don't have the time to do a lot of research without all the left and right swing. We're conservative. We're not Republican. We're not Democrat. We are conservative. And so I went looking for this organization that was geared specifically for conservative moms who were busy, and I really couldn't find it. There are a lot of really great organizations out there that are geared towards, you know, conservative women specifically, but I wanted something that was a little bit more geared towards how busy women are, mothers are. And so not finding that, I don't know what happened. I was driving home from D.C. one day after having lunch with a friend, and I was on this long three-hour drive, and I was kind of rattling my brain and figuring out what can I do. And I got home and I prayed, and the next morning this whole thing was born. And I had a vision of what I wanted the organization to look like, how it was going to be structured, and so basically that's what happened. I joke that I ran to the deep end of the conservative movement pool and I just kind of jumped right in. And so, and it's, you know, it's been a process of learning on the job. It's been greatly received, definitely is something that's needed. There are a lot of organizations that are geared towards moms on the left, and a lot of the organizations out there and websites that are out there that are for moms, that are targeting moms, women don't even realize that it's really swayed. And so our goal is to be a place where conservative moms can find other conservative moms, find that common goal and that common bond, and really work together and come together and make a better future for our families.
Absolutely. So it's not a far stretch to see that, you know, you've got some pet projects, some pet areas where you guys are kind of focused. Education is one. Education is a real hot button here on Culture Vigilante. We know that you've been watching the Common Core. What do you plan to do about that?
Basically, what we plan on doing is working with a number of coalition organizations that are specifically working on Common Core, and to organize, educate women, educate moms. There are so many moms out there that send their kids to public school who just they don't know any different. They don't know what's going on. And so our goal is to educate and inform and activate these women so that they can be their children's advocate, and they can also be the teacher's advocate, because there are a lot of teachers out there that don't really want to go with the structure, the top-down structure, and so but they can't really do anything about it because they don't have the support. And so what our goal is to form these groups, these mommy lobby groups in their communities, and, you know, really start to make the change and raise the voices of those women who really want to make a change for their children's future in as far as education, not just limited to education as well, but education is something that's very, very important to most women because their kids are in school.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, just kind of as a side, you know, when you're out there talking to the moms out there in general, what is the feedback that you're getting on education? Do they understand what Common Core is?
No. The majority of women and men, unfortunately, don't understand it because they hear what they hear on television. They hear the talking points on one channel or the other. When they're feeding, you know, when they're fixing supper, they may hear it on the news. They don't really understand what it really means. And what we're working on is we're still in the process of building our website and our organization, but what our goal is to make sure that women have access to the information about Common Core, about all these different, you know, fancy named programs like Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind, and we want to educate women and make sure that they truly understand what is at stake and how it's not what it seems, that it really is a wolf in sheep's clothing. But the majority of people that are out there, no, they don't. They really don't have a real good understanding.
Well, it's really hard. I mean, I have this conversation with people all the time. I mean, I live in a suburban neighborhood outside of the St. Louis area, and most of the people don't really understand. They don't know that I'm as deeply involved in the political movement as I am, because everybody's very busy.
Yeah,
you know, they're running their kids to soccer and to scouts.
Exactly.
And, you know, some of these moms are working moms, and, you know, I mean, they're so, you know, while they probably are unintentionally disengaged, you know, they try to keep up as best they can, but, you know, most people don't have, if you're that busy being a mom, you don't have time to be on the internet, you don't have time to vet your news out, you're just getting what you're fed.
And let's be honest, the last thing anybody wants to do at the end of the day, whether you're a working mom or a stay-at-home mom, whatever it is that you do, moms are busy, we spend all of our time really dedicating our lives to other people, because that's what we do, we're moms. the last thing most of us want to do at the end of the day, after we've gotten the kids in bed, after we've cleaned up all the dishes and got those last bits of laundry done, the last thing we want to do is sit down and try and do some research or read a white paper. And that is what really prompted me and got me motivated, because it is passion for me. I love doing this. I live for this now. And so if I can give back to women who are so busy and they have a place where they can go, that they know that they can trust the information, because that is one thing that is incredibly important to me, is my integrity and my organization's integrity. I have no problem admitting if I make a mistake. We want to make sure that the facts are getting out there and that women know the truth. And that is really what it boils down to. So what we hope to be is the place where moms can, at the end of the day or in the middle of the day, they'll get an email or however they want to get it, get the information fed to them. It's up to them. It's on their, on their schedule, whatever they want to do, but we want to make sure that they have the access to the information, that we've done all the hard work, and they can just go do and figure out exactly what's important to them and get the information they need so that they are well-educated.
So that was actually my next question to you. I mean, it's very hard. We've all faced that challenge in the grassroots movement and the Tea Party movement about how to educate and cast a wider net and to get information to those people who are not engaged for one reason or another. I mean, what kind of challenges are you facing? Are you meeting with resistance? Are people not, are they willing to take that information from you? How are you getting that information out there?
It's hard, and being that we are such a new organization, and, I'm kind of burning the candle from both ends of this. Of the end, both ends of the stick. I'm really bad at analogies. sorry. I asked my husband, if I try to tell a joke or do anything, I will mess it up, undoubtedly. Like, I just messed that one up. But anyway, but I'm really, I have had my challenges as far as getting the information out there. Social media is a great way to do it, but not out, when you're running social media, either on Facebook or Twitter, it's really hard because moms are busy and they don't spend, when you're taking care of a family, you don't have time to sit on Facebook and Twitter. You just don't.
Right.
And so what, as we grow and as we go along, basically what our organization plans to do is, depending on, we want to be specific to what how moms want to get the information. Right now it's word of mouth. We plan on using a lot of social media. We plan on using the emails, if that's what they're comfortable with. But as far as disseminating information, what I hope to do and what I hope to achieve is to use those mommy networks and to build little groups of women in each community and kind of let those women be the conduits of information and bring other women in. Because let's be honest, women talk to other women. Who do moms trust? They trust other moms. Mm-hmm. And so if one woman says, or if a couple women are sitting there talking, having coffee, at a play date, and they start talking about these things, which most likely they're not, so we're trying to prompt that information to get out there. If they start talking about it, then it kind of snowballs, and you really just kind of, use the resources that you have. And so what we hope to do is to use those mommy networks, is what we call them. And so far it's been pretty good. I mean, we've gotten pretty good as far as organization getting word out. We get a lot of positive feedback when women find out that we're here. They're like, thank goodness, it's finally somebody that understands us. So, I think it's, once we get going, I think there's a really, really great chance to gain a lot of momentum and to really make a positive change.
Excellent. Okay, so tell me, how are you going to reach out to folks here in Missouri?
Eventually, well, I'm counting on people like you to kind of get the word out as well. But eventually what we'll do is we'll start, I'm looking to build the organization and get a state director. So if you know anybody, if you're connected to anybody that might be interested in doing that, definitely connect them with me. But what we plan on doing is having a state director and then kind of breaking it down into regions and then locally. And then we'll come into the communities. We'll provide the information that women need and basically just kind of trickle it down and let the women just kind of take over on their own, because women are really good at stuff like that. Moms are really good about sharing information that they're passionate about. So,
okay,
excellent. That's our goal.
Well, how do we get in touch with you, Cindy? MommyLobby.com?
We are at www.themommylobby.org, and we're also on Facebook, and we also have a Twitter following, so if you want to check us out there, and yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Please, I hope you will come back and keep us posted.
Definitely.
On the developments and let
Absolutely.
Us know how things are going and just kind of give us some general updates. We really appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah. Sounds good. Well, I appreciate you having me, and I will definitely be in touch, and let's get this thing going.
Okay, very good. Themommylobby.net.
Yep. .org.
.org. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thanks so much.
Okay,
thanks.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Okay. I've been talking to Cindy McGee here for about 3 weeks now, I've been trying to get folks on to talk about preparedness issues. And Cindy has come on for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and we were going to do it, and we kept running short on time, and and she keeps coming back because she's tenacious and she's passionate about this issue. She has done a lot of research on this, and preparedness is an issue that we haven't touched on here at Culture Vigilante yet, but a lot of people in the grassroots community are very concerned. I guess the best way to describe people who are passionate about preparedness is that they have a plan B passion. You know, plan A is to fix it. Plan B is to be prepared if it doesn't get fixed. So there are a lot of folks out there, a lot of organizations, a lot of places that you can go for preparedness info. But I want to kind of open up a discussion here on Culture Vigilante and kind of put that out there so that people can kind of start to think about preparedness as you know, a necessary insurance plan in case things don't happen for us the way that we're trying to make it happen. And Cindy has agreed to come on and give us a few helpful tips. So thank you, Cindy, finally, for being here and being open to talking about preparedness on Culture Vigilante.
No problem. Thank you for letting me talk about this. I think it's an important subject that people really need to think about, because I love what you said about insurance. You know, we buy health insurance, we buy life insurance, we buy insurance for our homes, our cars, and all of these different types of insurance policies to protect us from disaster, and be it natural or man-made. And our homes and the things that we insure can be affected by either a natural or man-made disaster. And the thing about it is that when it comes to preparedness, to putting by extra food, knowing that you have a source for water in the event that somehow you don't have access to water for any given period of time, making sure that you have transportation if you need to leave your location, knowing that you have adequate shelter in an emergency, you know, all of those things are important. And it's just insurance against the natural disasters and possibly man-made disasters that we can face in life.
Well, you know, and the natural disasters, I mean, people kind of look at you a little funny. You know, if they're not, especially if they're not part of the grassroots movement, they think you're wearing a tinfoil hat if you talk about, you know, being prepared. If, you know, because most of the average folks don't believe that the government will or can collapse. You know, and that, you know, that you won't have any money, you won't have any food, water, electricity, that most of the people don't believe that something could happen. But, so if you don't want to go down that road, I mean, we've had enough natural disasters in this country in the last 5 years for people, you know, we've had tornadoes here in Missouri that have been devastating. You know, we've had hurricanes, we've had, you know, there are earthquakes around the world. I mean, you just don't know. And it's crazy to not have a plan B.
It is crazy not to have a plan B. And, you know, what people don't realize, I'll tell you what, my first wake-up call to this actually came from our then Congressman Aiken back 4 years ago. He came and spoke to Show Me Patriots. And at that time, we were trying to figure out how to fight what was happening in Washington, D.C., how to stop Obamacare and all of that. And we asked him to come in and speak to our group about what we could do to how we could be effective and affect change. And when he spoke to us, he said, right now, honestly, in Washington, D.C., there's not a lot we can do to fight what they're doing. We're going to do the best we can, but we're outmanned, outgunned, outnumbered. And that was true. But he said, something I can talk to you about is, he said, I'm on the National Security Defense Committee, and he said, I have things come across my desk every day, and I can't talk about them here, but he said, I will tell you that what every American can and should do is have a plan to take care of their family for at least 2 weeks in the event of some type of disaster. And he said, we live in a just-in-time society. And what that means, Lisa, is that, okay, we've got a big storm about to hit Missouri tomorrow. Oh, mm-hmm. Tonight and into tomorrow morning. I ran to the grocery store this evening, as did, I'll bet, a whole lot of people listening. And I noticed that the shelves were already starting to thin out a bit. And basically, because of how our society is and how dependent we are on electronics and our computers and the way our transportation system works and everything that ships all of our goods to and from where we are is that we basically only have about a 3-day supply on our grocery shelves to take care of our entire community. And if you have a disaster that cuts you off for whatever reason from shipping, or those stores no longer exist because of a tornado, a hurricane, or whatever, those shelves are empty probably within a day in a situation like that. Then where are you going to go for food? Where are you going to go for water? What are you going to do to take care of your family? Because believe it or not, it's not the government's responsibility. You're going to be the first responder for your family. So you need to have a plan in place. You need to have food. You need to have water. You need to have transportation. You need to have shelter. And I'm going to say it out loud in the midst of the big gun debate. You need to have a way to defend what you have.
Right, right.
And those are your priorities in your preparedness plan. And how you want to structure that is up to you. They're great. I mean, there are so many different ways to go in putting food away to feed your family in an emergency. You can plan for a couple of a week, 48 hours a week, a month, 3 months, 6 months, a year. That's up to you. But you should start somewhere, at least start with a 48-hour plan. And when I look at what happened in New York City with the hurricane a few months ago, there were a lot of people there, and there were serious problems in New York. The shelves were empty. What I'm talking about was happening, and government is very slow to respond and doesn't really, we've seen it with Katrina, sometimes mm-hmm. really not adequate. And you have people there, though, that, and I heard them talking in interviews on radio programs and stuff afterwards, that were so thankful that they had an alternative way to cook their meals, that they had put food by, that they had water stored, and they were able to take care of their families. They had candles, they had lanterns, whatever, because they were without power. They did not have the resources that they normally have at hand to provide for their families, to take care of their families. But because they had a plan, they were surviving. Those who didn't were waiting in lines, sitting in tents. They were going to stores and finding the shelves empty, and they were getting desperate.
Right. Well, we saw with the cruise ship stranded in the Gulf of Mexico last week, and we heard the stories about how people get desperate so quickly. I mean, these folks were on a cruise ship. They had, I mean, you know, it wasn't pleasant, but they had, you know, people there to help them, to take care of them. There was food there, but still, I mean, you have to kind of look at your culture here, folks. People, we have very seriously gotten lazy and very unwilling and unknowingly, we don't know how to take care of ourselves if things fall apart. And it becomes very unnerving, you know, and we become very different, a very different culture very quickly when we are taken out of our normal environment. And, you know, you just, how you handle your life is really tested in these situations. It doesn't have to be a collapse of the government, you know, it can be some kind of a natural disaster, but, you know, things can go south very quickly.
They really can. And, you know, and anything from a catastrophic event like the total collapse of your economy or a significant collapse of the economy, an EMP, a horrific terrorist attack. There are a lot of ways that things can be a cyber attack. I mean, so catastrophically, there are terrible mm-hmm. things that can happen. And then you're going to be in a situation where your society is going to completely degrade in a hurry because it isn't going to take long for people to be starving and dehydrating, and people, something, you know, that I'd never really thought about was people, how many people are on drugs these days for depression or on antipsychotic drugs and all of this type of thing. In a situation where you have a complete breakdown, these people are suddenly without what they need. And your situation can degrade in a hurry. And we don't really want to think about that, and we probably shouldn't dwell on it. But, you know, it's really... It's like having that life insurance policy there. If you've got it, then the fears and the concerns that you have of losing a spouse and suddenly losing income and not being able to do things the way you've been doing them, you have that assurance that you have a plan B in the event that that terrible thing happens so that you can continue to take care of your family and your life is not completely turned upside down. And, you know, just think about how desperate you would become if you found yourself 3, 4, 5 days into some type of natural disaster, or catastrophic disaster, whatever it may be, and you cannot feed your family. What are you going to be willing to do to put food on the table to make sure that your children don't starve?
Yeah, and what do you and what do you well others do? And I think the signs are there, folks. It's just foolish for us not to read the signs of because we can see it. You know, we've seen it. People get just crazy. You know, and you do. You have to be able to protect yourself. You have to know who you can trust. You have to know how to take care of yourself when things kind of get more or less savage.
Yes. And, you know, Lisa, the thing is that, you know, that cruise ship is a really, really, really good example of how bad it can get in a hurry. Those people were not in danger of starving. Their facilities were interrupted, but they didn't have to resort to the things that they did. And they didn't have. It didn't have to be that they were dealing with terrible sanitation issues simply because they were not willing to use the buckets available and dump it over the boat. You know, there were a lot of things going on that cruise ship that were absolutely disgusting and showed the worst side of humanity when they're suddenly challenged. But what was their challenge really? They
right.
were being inconvenienced, no doubt about it. It was not the cruise that they had planned. But there was never any doubt the company would make it up to them, which they will. They weren't in danger of starving. They weren't in danger of not having water and dehydrating. They were going to get off that ship. There was an end in sight. There was light at the end of the tunnel. And yet they degraded, some of them, and acted like savages.
Right. Right.
And, you know, we're living in dangerous times. We're living in times that are very concerning. And I think there are a lot of good people in society that would strive to do things in a way that would be honorable in trying to provide for their families, but there are those that have no honor, and, you know, you need to take a look at that too. But I think that my message to the patriots, to people who, the honorable people in our society, is that have a plan to care for your family in the event that you suddenly find your life completely disrupted and that you find you no longer have things available that you are used to having available. Be sure that you can feed your family, that you can provide hydration, that you can provide shelter, that you have transportation in case you have to evacuate an area, and have a plan to take your supplies with you. And, you know, it's a pretty simple thing, and it's a good insurance policy.
So a very easy way to get started into looking into this for folks that are going to be smart enough to try to put a plan in place for themselves and to start believing that this is a possibility for themselves is to maybe Google just preparedness
mm-hmm.
issues. I mean, there's a ton of information out there on the Internet.
Another thing you can do is just start Googling food storage. Google preparedness. And, you know, you're gonna hit some nut sites. I'm not going to say you might find a couple of nutty sites, and but there are a lot. There's just a huge amount of information available on the Internet. This has become a really big issue to a lot of people, and it's a growing concern. Another thing that you can do, I'm certainly not LDS, but you can go to, you know, the LDS website. The LDS Church has a lot of things available about food storage and how to have a plan to feed your family. Whether you choose to use dehydrated foods or you want to use conventional foods that you find on your grocery shelves, you can. There are things out there to help you streamline your plan to meet your needs and to meet your what you're comfortable with. And so I would just, you're right, Google preparedness and just look for there's just a plethora of things out there that you can choose from.
Yeah.
And just start doing your research. And if nothing else, every time you go to the grocery store, pick up an extra case of drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
Pick up some extra canned goods from the shelves, you know, meats, vegetables, fruits, you know, and also don't forget to pick up some fun things, some, you know, chocolate candies, especially if you have children,
mm-hmm.
Because they, think about comfort things that they may need in a disaster or a situation where their world has been turned upside down too.
And hygiene.
Fun things in there. Yeah, and hygiene, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. Think about hygiene, toilet paper, just the basic necessities that we need. And don't think that you can run down to the pond down the street and get water out and boil it, and it's necessarily going to be safe to drink. You, first of all, you're not going to want to drink muddy water even if it has been boiled. So think about some type of filtration system. I mean, they have everything from good sports bottle type drinking filtration systems that you can get, that a lot of hikers and stuff use, so that if they have to depend on a stream, that filter in that bottle will filter out most bacteria and harmful things. And just make sure you're getting a good one. Think about getting water purification tablets. Keep a few extra pillowcases on hand, because you can strain most of the debris and garbage out of water that way. But you have to have something that will kill the bacteria and germs. And the longer a situation degrades, especially in a more urban and area and around more populated areas, those types of water supplies are going to be affected by human waste and all sorts of things that will start to happen as a result of that situation, and therefore that drinking water can become lethal, because in a situation where you don't have enough food or water, if you develop dysentery or something like that, it can kill you in a matter of hours to days.
So is it absolutely and necessarily more involved than stocking up on pure water filters? Do you need to go to your Uncle Sam's and buy some survival supplies, or?
Depends on how far you want to take your plan. If you want to be prepared for everything from a snowstorm and you suddenly found yourself without electricity for a day or two, to being prepared for a catastrophic event, you start, there's a wide range of things that you can be preparing for, and it's up to you to decide how far you want to carry that. If you want to carry it to be able to be self-sustaining for a long period of time, then you do want to look at other supplies that and resources that are available for people to be self-sustaining for a long period of time when life as we know it comes to an end. And so those things are available through those preparedness things. Everything from sun ovens that you can cook in, just with solar, just with the sun, that work very well. Propane, have some propane and a way to cook with a propane cooker. You can have wood stove. If you have a wood stove, that's also a good way to be able to continue to cook and provide warm meals for your family and boil water. Those things become important in that situation. Think about sanitation supplies for a long-term catastrophic event. What would you do about your hygiene needs and toilet needs? There are composting toilets out there, or you can buy lime and you can dig holes and you can bury the waste safely. There are just a lot of different ways you can look at going with all of this, and how far you take it is just going to really depend on how it's just how far do you want to take it.
Right.
What do you feel you want to be prepared for, and what do you want to be prepared to do? I urge everyone to at least plan for a 2-week to 1-month emergency where you have the ability to take care of your family. And try to keep it somewhat portable, too, in case you do find that you have to leave your location to move somewhere else.
So storing gasoline?
Yes, storing gasoline for your car to make sure that keep your gas tank full. That's always that's good advice for anybody at any time. Any of us can get stuck in a bad situation. I'll bet just about everybody's been in a situation where they were going to get gas on the way home, find themselves on the interstate in the middle of an accident, and they're looking at their gas gauge somewhere
right.
between empty and a quarter of a tank and thinking, why didn't I stop and get gas before this? So don't take for granted that you're going to be able to get to a gas station to get gas if you need to get somewhere. And it is a good idea to keep a couple of cans of gasoline stored and keep your gas tank full. That's all, it's a good point. And more if you want to, Now, gasoline over time will degrade, and you have there are things you can put in it. But, you know, for long-term storage, you've got to, you know, gasoline is going to have to be rotated because it will degrade and become useless to you.
Right.
So, but it will last for a year or more, depending on how well you've stored it, and still be safe to use in your car and get the job done. But after that, it will start degrading, and so basically just rotate it, you know, when you and mm-hmm. also keep it doesn't hurt to have some of it. They have everything from little bitty camp stoves that take little pellets that will boil water in about 11 seconds, actually about a minute. You know, and if you've got dehydrated foods, that's all you need is hot water to add to them, and you've got a meal prepared. It doesn't hurt to also maybe have a bug-out bag for every member of the family that will sustain them for 48 to 72 hours. That way, if you're in a weather emergency and you have to move to a shelter or whatever, you can have things to provide for your own family in that situation, and you don't have to depend on other services to take care of you and maybe have things that they're going to like better.
Yeah. Okay, amazing. This is a topic that we can discuss at length for a very, very long time, and I hope, Cindy, that you'll come back and give us some more tips as we go along. I just think this is something that people need to start thinking about. There's a lot of information out there. It's not hard to get, but I think most of all, probably the most important thing that we really need to do is to start thinking about scenarios. I mean, we have lived such an easy life in an easy culture for so very long that we're not the possible scenarios don't even come to mind that
right.
we might need to start thinking about. So, you know, if we can just get that conversation going.
Right. And, you know, Lisa, let's be honest here. Preparedness is good for anything from a minor to major catastrophe. And 4 years ago, I was not thinking catastrophic events other than maybe a terrorist attack, you know, some type of nuclear attack on the United States or something along that line, something that we don't even want to think about. But, you know, right now we're living in a world in a time when there are all sorts of people warning us that we're facing a potentially very catastrophic event with our economy, our world economy, mm-hmm. and it's going to affect the U.S. When you look at Europe and what's happening, if those dominoes start to fall, and I believe they very well may, we're not going to escape that unscathed, and you would be surprised how fast life as you know it could come to an end if that scenario plays out. And I pray that it doesn't, but I think that our government has been so irresponsible. We'll just leave it at that.
Very
actually,
remiss.
They've been criminal in what they've done. And they have left us so vulnerable, and they are not doing anything to correct the path that we're on. And it's not sustainable. We all know that. It's not sustainable. Look at Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Look what that's going to do to our economy. When everything factors in, it's going to be devastating, just that alone. So, you know, buy some extra food. Buy some extra water. Start working on your insurance plan. Plan B.
Plan B. Okay. Thank you, Cindy McGee. We really appreciate that information. And that is great, great advice. And I hope that you'll come back on and give us tips as we go along, because I think that's a conversation that needs to continue as we move forward here.
It does.
All right. I think we're going to wrap it up tonight, folks. We had a very quick blow through with legislative issues, and thank you to Cindy McGee again one more time for sitting in and helping us with that preparedness info. Next week, we will have Gary Wigert on with us. There's some taxes going on here in the St. Louis area. The folks in the St. Louis area or some of the politicians, let's say, in the St. Louis area are trying to find a way to pay for upgrades to the arch, and they're trying to extend those fingers out and beyond. And actually, we'll talk to the folks maybe at Americans for Prosperity, too, if we can get them back on. They issued a press release about a week ago of just a long laundry list of taxes that are up for debate and decision in the coming elections. So we'll hit on some of those issues next week, and maybe a few more as we can drum them up. And thank you for being with us. We're here every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. This is your Culture Vigilante Hour on Missouri Grassroots Radio. We will be back here again next Wednesday. Hope to see you here.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.